and welcome to this Innovation Forum podcast, or in fact, a webinar, co-hosted with the Accountability Framework Initiative. I'm Ian Welsh from Innovation Forum, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Today, we're going to be discussing the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on ethical supply chains. The pandemic has disrupted nearly every aspect of life on the planet, not least the way that goods are produced and distributed. How are companies' sustainability and ethical supply chain efforts adapting to the disruption? And how can we all work together to achieve these goals? That's what we're going to be discussing for the next hour. I'm delighted that joining me are Akiba Fishman, Manager for Forests with WWF USA, Roland Arriva-Song, Sustainability Director, Telcar Coco, and Samuel Avala, General Manager, Benzo Oil Palm Plantation Limited. Roland's in Cameroon and Samuel's in Ghana. My thanks to Ryan Thompson and the Accountability Framework Initiative team for helping to convene our expert panel. I will shortly invite our panelists to answer some opening questions to kick us off. We will then have some follow-up discussion, and I will open up the debate to audience questions. We do want to hear from you all, so please submit questions using the box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Please try and keep the questions short and to the point, and if you do, it is more likely that I will use them. As usual for Innovation Forum sessions, we have no long presentations today, just focused discussion. We are recording the audio, and you will receive a link to this in due course when it is edited and published on the Innovation Forum podcast channel. Okay, well, welcome everybody. Akiba, let me turn to you first, if I may. Akiba Fishman from WWF, welcome. Perhaps introduce yourself and also give a bit of insight, please, as to how the accountability framework can help businesses and their stakeholders maintain supply chains during such persistent challenges as we've seen as we deal with the COVID pandemic. Akiba.
Great, thanks so much, Ian. So my name is Akiba Fishman, and I work with WWF on the role of commodity production in driving deforestation and ecosystem conversion. And I work directly with companies on fulfilling their responsible supply chain commitments. And I also represent WWF on the steering group of the Accountability Framework Initiative. So to your question, the short answer is that the Accountability Framework Initiative, or AFI for short, is right now laser focused on driving uptake of the set of guidance that it published last year on achieving ethical supply chains that are free of deforestation, conversion of other ecosystems, and human rights abuses. And this guidance can help companies keep their bearings and maintain focus on the how of achieving these goals during this time of turmoil. So let me take a step back for a minute and just put this guidance into context. AFI formed several years ago to address a set of persistent challenges that have hindered companies from fulfilling their ethical supply chain commitments. Some of these challenges had to do with properly setting commitments. For example, commitments often weren't sufficiently ambitious and frequently use widely differing definitions of key concepts like deforestation. Other challenges related to effectively implementing commitments, including inconsistent approaches used by companies to assess risk or report on progress. Over the course of 2 years, a group of global and regional NGOs gathered together many, many times to hash out a consensus on the best practices for addressing deforestation, conversion of natural ecosystems, and human rights issues in supply chains. We then consulted with a wide range of organizations, including companies in a variety of commodity markets and across the value chain, as well as reporting and assessment initiatives and governments. We finally launched the accountability framework in June of 2019. And since then, we've been actively working with companies, industry associations, service providers, and others to apply the framework's guidance to implement corporate supply chain commitments. One dynamic that I think will come out prominently in today's discussion is the degree to which companies have been relying on certification to help meet their commitments on protection of forests and other ecosystems. And this can be a really appropriate strategy, particularly when relying on robust and credible certification systems. But as I think we'll hear, certification has some limitations, and companies are often left with uncertified volumes entering their value chain. And that's where the accountability framework can be especially helpful as a set of best practices to address the risks associated with that uncertified supply. Now, we've seen a lot of progress in the last year, including alignment of widely used corporate reporting and assessment systems like CDP and Forest 500 with the framework. We've also seen the framework's definitions of key terms referenced in the proposed process for the new due diligence legislation that's advancing through the EU, and a report from the British government that was released in March recommended that the framework be used as the basis for the UK's new reporting initiative for imported deforestation. We're also seeing individual companies align their policies and implementation procedures with the framework. And some, like McDonald's, Cargill, Mars, are even referencing the framework publicly on their websites. On top of that, industry groups are now using elements of the framework to align their member policies and guidelines with the framework's global best practices. So now, in the face of the global crisis that we're in, what we really want is for the accountability framework to continue serving as a resource for companies and other organizations that are looking to advance in their journey toward deforestation and conversion-free supply chains that respect human rights. COVID-19 has, of course, significantly complicated the picture for corporate supply chains, and the framework exists to provide the guideposts so that companies know what it takes to maintain focus on eliminating the very same destructive practices that studies indicate can increase the risk of future zoonotic disease transmission. I'm really excited to hear from Roland and Samuel how they see the virus affecting their company's ethical supply chain efforts and how they are adapting while maintaining their social and environmental commitments. The coalition that powers the accountability framework is really eager to continue supporting companies through this difficult period with best practices for achieving these commitments.
Thank you very much indeed, Akiva. So just by way of further introduction, I mean, obviously the everything's been impacted by the pandemic, but to what extent, Akiva, are you hopeful that this might give us, this, if you like, might jolt into action many people who haven't been engaging with their supply chain issues correctly? I mean, I know there's a cliche said, never waste a good crisis, but to what extent do you think that might be the case this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic is really drawing into focus for a lot of companies the risks inherent in their supply chains when they are sourcing commodities that are tightly wound up in land, because we are increasingly seeing this linkage being made between loss of forests and other natural ecosystems and the ability of viruses to jump over from animal populations into humans. And the more and more that we push into the natural frontiers, the greater the likelihood that these viruses will increasingly transfer over to the human population. And so I think companies are realizing that they are potentially implicated in the risk associated with this future disease transmission. And this is adding to the justification for taking a really strong focus on cleaning up supply chains, making sure that they are not driving deforestation and conversion.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Akiva. We'll look forward to hearing more from you later in our discussion. Let me turn now to Samuel Avella from BOPP. Welcome to the webinar. Why don't you introduce yourself a bit? And also, I've got a question for you initially, and really it's around how your sustainability efforts have changed whilst working with smallholders and others. I know that BOPP is RSPO certified in terms of its direct production, its direct palm oil production, but you also have, and you have many certified producers, but some of your supply comes from smallholders and others. So how have your efforts changed engaging with them? Samuel.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, by way of introduction, my name is Samuel Avala, the general manager of Ben's Oil Palm Plantation. And also, my other hat is I'm the president of the Oil Palm Development Association of Ghana. And that is the private sector association of actors in the value chain of the palm oil value chain in Ghana. And we have been working in all the advocacies that is aimed at the sustainable development of the palm oil value chain in Ghana. First of all, a little bit background of our company. Our company started as a Unilever, a joint venture between the government of Ghana and Unilever in the mid-70s, and as an oil palm plantation. And over time, Unilever has had to divest itself of its stake in the business, and that was taken over by Wilmar. International through their Wilmar Africa subsidiary. And the company is also listed on the Ghana Stock Exchange. And in 2014, were the first in Ghana and second in Africa to become RSPO certified. And in the pre-certification era, we operated largely with and under what we used to call the Unilever Sustainable Agriculture. And so for us, we've had a history and a foundation of ethical and sustainable supply chain as far as our operations are concerned. And we have continued the same even in the current Wilmar regime. And as you know, Wilmar is a big player in the oil palm sector globally and also has undoubted commitments to sustainable production and, for that matter, forest protection. Now, to come to the question that you have asked straight away, our production as we speak now is made up of about 50% of our raw material base coming from our own nucleus plantation and 25% coming from a scheme smallholder that is part of our concession, and the other 25% coming from independent outgrowers scattered over an area of about 100 kilometer radius to where we are located. So yes, we have in total a base that is about 75% from certified sources of raw material, that's the palm fruits, and 25% coming from the wider outgrower, which is not exactly certified, but we get them to try and operate under sustainable conditions and practices. So that being the case, then in the era of COVID-19, we find ourselves having to build on existing platforms, existing foundations, which foundations have been built, and as I told you, on sustainable agriculture practices as we were in during the Unilever era. And now under RSPO, and even with the RSPO, the certification audits and the surveillance audits, which we had our CIF surveillance audit just last week. Now, these and many other things have made COVID-19 accommodatable for us in the immediate term. And I say it's accommodatable because as part of our sustainable practices, we have our clinic or hospital with medical facilities that serve our employees and their dependents on the estate, and goes beyond that to also serve the communities, the seven communities around us, around our catchment area. And so we have a setup that is probably already looking ahead. And so COVID-19 has not taken us by surprise at all. Indeed, we have, as part of our management practices, and what we call emergency response management systems, which includes the existence of a crisis management committee, which we have activated at different times depending on what crisis or emergencies are imminent, whether it is a political activity that is coming and we believe there could be upheavals and troubles, or even Ebola and the H1N1 flu. All these times, we had to reactivate our existing crisis management team. And in the case of COVID, we just had to reconstitute the crisis management committee to be able to address COVID specifically. So we have a crisis management team, and in this particular case, headed by our medical doctor, who is our own employee and resident here. And we have activated our medical facility, the clinic, to look out for cases and to include investigations and OPD, triangling which should be able to capture cases upfront. And so we have modified our SOPs in terms of how many people can be in one vehicle to travel to their workplaces and back, on reporting at our facility at the various gates and entrances. Temperatures have to be taken, hand sanitizing stations and facilities have been provided, so that whether they are outsiders or our own employees reporting to our premises or their areas of work, we have systems in place which were just built on existing protocols activated specifically to address COVID-19. And we have a WhatsApp platform of the Crisis Management Committee for COVID-19, where we have daily updates of information of infection rates and case counts for our district and also at the national level. So we can see how we stand and the risk that we face. So out of the 25% of our production base, which we get from outside our own plantation, we are monitoring to see which communities and aggregation centers are probably getting infected cases. And recently, we had to take a decision to shut off one particular community because they recorded the first two cases of COVID-19 infection in our district, the district where we operate. So we have a plan in place that says that if the infection rates begin to affect more and more of our operational areas or aggregation centers, we could and would declare our own kind of lockdown so that those places are excluded from our areas of aggregation until we are sure that the situation is normalized. Now, this is how specific, in specific terms, how maybe COVID-19 has or is beginning to impact our operation. But in the broader sense, we have seen that our in terms of our preparedness and positioning to be able to deal with the issues, certainly and surely our RSPO certification and the things that require that we, the standards we are supposed to maintain, have helped us to be in the good position to be able to contain and address COVID-19 without any significant impact on our business. But I must also say that we have opened our doors for some other assessments, such as a verification assessment with TFT in the last 3 years. And more importantly and relevantly too, we have undergone our site was chosen for the proof of concept or test of concept or framework for the AFI for the oil palm sector in Ghana and perhaps in Africa. And that certainly has helped us to further reinforce the sustainable practices that we have. And also, we have had the benefit of seeing where else we can improve. So when it comes to the AFI framework, again, that assessment that we opened up for has helped us to be in a good position to be able to address COVID-19 amidst our operations. So yes, I would say that the accountability framework for the AFI in particular, just as the others like RSPO, the TFT, and other frameworks such as the Marrakesh Declaration of the Africa Palm Oil Initiative, APOI, all of this, which we have submitted ourselves to in the past, have now proven to be more useful in the sense that they have been difficult, but they have prepared us to be able to run our business without much upheavals, even in the era of COVID-19. That is what I would say as my opening remarks. And I think that more than before, we now have every justification and every reason why frameworks such as the AFI, the RSPO, and the similar ones are a necessary imperative for any business or value chain that is truly, that intends to be truly ethical and truly resilient and sustainable. Thank you.
Thank you. No, thank you very much indeed, Samuel. It's interesting that how you described there that whilst using the RSPO and being involved with the RSPO certification, and now the using EFI, the Accountability Framework Initiative, that has helped your business become or be more able to deal with the challenges of the pandemic. And I hope we can come to some more of them over the course of our discussion. But thank you very, very much indeed. Roland, perhaps I can turn to you. I understand that your business sources cocoa from certified and non-certified producers via cooperatives and individual farmers. So how has the, similar question to you as I put to Samuel, so how has the epidemic affected your work and your sourcing in particular with the cooperatives and smallholders? Roland.
So thank you, Ian. So coming back again, I am Roland Arebison. I'm the Sustainability Director of Telka Cocoa Limited in Cameroon. Telka Cocoa is a Kage joint venture. So basically since 2011, we've been implementing the Kage Cocoa Promise, which today the Kage Cocoa Promise, we have our activities are centered around five goals. The first goal is farmer livelihood. So we look forward to, we're trying to maximize farmers' profitability through increased productivity. We do try to enable farmers to receive the benefits of professional farmers' organizations. Our goal two is community well-being. And in Cameroon, we implemented the child level monitoring remediation system. We are implementing projects about portable drinking water, and we are implementing projects around women empowerment. Goal three is protecting our planet. So in Cameroon, basically, we are engaged in the Green Cocoa Landscape Program. We are engaged in the roadmap to deforestation-free cocoa. And also, we are engaged in mapping of farms in our supply chains. Group four is our consumer confidence, where we have our first mile traceability project, where we want to assure our consumers that all the products we actually supply to them are traceable. And the fifth goal is transformation together, where we work with other structures like IFC, IDH, WWF, Syngenta, ICI, USAID, and eventually AFI to be able to bring transformational changes to communities. Coming back to your question, Ian, how has the COVID-19 affected our operations? If you look at our operations, we work directly with farmers. Sometimes we work, for example, in our farmer preschool sessions. We have sessions of an average 30 farmers that we have to bring together. We have coaching of farmers in cooperatives. And so basically, when we have to put the context of COVID-19, firstly, when we have to do social distances, quite kind of limit the number of farmers that we can work with at a particular time. So basically, we are having now more sessions than initially. For example, sessions of 30 farmers, we have to divide this training session into 15-15. So we have multiple sessions. We are called upon to be able to, since we are dealing one-on-one with farmers, to be able to stop the spread of COVID-19, we have to try to protect both the farmers and protect both our facilitators, our trainers. So of recent, what we've done, we've been able to distribute masks to the farmers. We've been able to distribute sabots. We've also been able to distribute sanitizers. This is all in a bid to be able to reduce the spread of COVID-19. And actually, the incidence of COVID-19 did hit at a time in Cameroon where we're actually at the light crop season, because we have two crop seasons in Cameroon. The light crop season is characterized by low production. And so when it did hit immediately, we had most of our activities put on hold. Eventually, we reopened our activities as we are going into the crop season. And so we are taking measures to be able to protect the farmers, to limit the spread of COVID-19, and to ensure that our activities go on smoothly. So basically, we have to try to protect the farmers, which we have been actually limiting the number of farmers in a particular sessions. This means we're having multiple sessions. We have an increase in the cost of our operations, because the cost of operations will now increase because we will have multiple sessions to conduct. And we'll try to ensure that other recommendations that have been recommended by the government of Cameroon and the World Health Organizations are being actually implemented by these farmers. So thank you, Ian. I will come back to other questions.
No, thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Roland. Have you found, I know you're, or I understand that you use OOT certified, or OOT certification for some of your working with some of your producers. Have you found, as Samuel mentioned, that using and having the kind of rigor, if you like, of a certification system has enabled more robustness and ability to deal with the challenges from the pandemic?
Certainly, because the certification system has a set of recommendations and control points that you need to apply to be able to be to able to gain conformity compliance. And basically, when you do apply all these recommendations or the control points, you take it a step further, a step ahead of such challenges that might come in the supply chain. So basically, yes, all the certification and OOT certification system, eventually the rainforest that has come into place over the years, has prepared us against such challenges. Now, basically, you want to think about the farmers who have not been part of us or of our certification scheme, because we source from our farmers who are part of our certification scheme, and we also source from some farmers who are not part of our certification scheme. But our goal, our long-term goal, is that all these farmers should be part of our sustainability supply chain. So basically, the OOT certification system in its control points have been able to already adapt us to the challenges that the COVID-19 has brought forth.
Okay, no, thank you very much indeed. Okay, next question I'd like to put to both both Samuel and Roland. I wonder if you could tell us in some, you've talked, thank you for, you know, a very introducing general terms, how you've been working differently with groups, but are there any particular new ways that you've worked with suppliers, or are you indeed finding demand from buyers that are impacting your sustainability work over the past few months? Samuel, you first.
First of all, what I would like to say is that in terms of new demands, everything that has come up has not taken us by surprise. For instance, when it comes to dealing with the communities around us, where our outgrowers and suppliers emanate from, we already have an existing CSR policy by which we engage them on regular basis and discuss our policies and our terms and conditions for continuing business. So it's did not come as a surprise. In fact, we were the ones who rather went forward asking them to also look at the social distancing and the hand sanitizing and all the protocols that are meant to protect people against COVID-19. So, in fact, we have rather been the proactive ones moving forward and bringing demands rather than the other way around. But in terms of the operations, yes, just as my colleague Roland said, in terms of transportation, we have had to cut the number of passengers that a bus or a truck, a labor transporter can take, to about half, so that we can allow for social distancing and so on and so forth. And we have cut meetings to the barest minimum. And so in terms of meetings, if it is not critical and very essential, we don't have in-person physical meetings. We have installed local radio stations on our divisions which we use to communicate and to educate and to inform, so that people don't have to come together in large numbers in one place. So on our side, we have been the ones rather putting forward and dictating the new terms and conditions for engagement, rather than the system and the people and stakeholders bringing that upon us. And again, I go back to this point I made, that it is the sustainability commitments and principles and the framework by which we account for our compliance and commitment that have made us to be in good stead, to rather be the ones putting the demands on our suppliers and stakeholders, rather than they bringing it upon us. But of course, a little more additional cost, because some of the PPEs that we are giving to our clinic and our workers and their dependents have come as added cost. But again, we didn't have to create even a new code, accounting code for this, because our system recognizes and social responsibility and the health and wellness of our people and the communities around us. So again, it comes to the point that because of our commitments to the different frameworks and how we allow ourselves to be assessed and to be rated, we have been in a better position to be one ahead of the game and bringing and imposing the conditions and the standards, rather than the system imposing on us. Apart from the additional costs, which also we are able to contain, the only thing has been the reducing palm oil prices on the global market, which is a global phenomenon. Otherwise, in local terms, we are the ones dictating the pace, rather than the system dictating the pace for us to follow. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Roland, perhaps I can put a similar question to you. And I'm particularly interested actually in how the demands from buyers that you have had to deal with, how they've been changing over the course of the past few months, and how that's impacted your own work.
So actually, I wouldn't say the system has imposed on us. We had to react we had to be fast on that one. We had to actually take one step ahead to remain in the sustainable supply chain. So basically, firstly, we did an analysis of how could we adapt to the current crisis, and we realized that firstly, we could not work continuously with the farmers while exposing them to the risk of being affected by COVID-19. We couldn't send our employees, our facilitators to the field without protecting them. That would have meant trying to increase the number of cases of COVID-19. So basically, we did this analysis and realized that, okay, firstly, we need to equip our workers, we need to equip our facilitators with masks, we need to give them sanitizers, we need also to reduce the number of people we work in with at a particular time to respect social distancing. So this is something we were a bit proactive to take to ensure that the system doesn't put the pressure on us. And we did this, and today we think it's working. We think basically today we can go on with our operations with the farmers without too much risk of them being infected by the COVID-19. And from the other end, we have our buyers, we have our customers that also we have to report to. So basically, on one-on-one basis, we are looking on the demands of the customers and see what we can actually do to be in alignment with them.
Hello, Roland. Oh dear, have we lost Roland? Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for the that response. You'll be able to rejoin us. Okay, let me turn back to Samuel then. I think it's clear that one of the biggest challenges from the crisis is it's limiting the ability of companies to verify activities on the ground. So, Samuel, how have you and your teams been coping to continue monitoring environmental and human rights risks? Samuel.
Yeah, thank you very much. We already have a system of internal audits and monitoring on the HCVs and other, if you like, EHS or environment health and safety standards that we have set to ourselves and also by the RSPO and the like. So we are almost running as if it was business as usual, except that we now have to add the other dimension, because our HCV monitoring orders still go on monthly as before. But this time, if our people have to go into community, previously going into communities did not require elaborate personal protective equipment, but now it does, because they will have to make sure they have their face masks and that they have their alcohol-based hand sanitizers and all of that. So yes, I would say that we have had to only add the dimensions of our safety protocols that cater for COVID-19 specifically, in addition to all the others that we have been covering. So indeed, in terms of numbers, we don't allow our people to meet large numbers, must meet them in a manner and in a form that allows for social distancing and all the other protocols. So again, I go back to the point that because of the kind of commitments, the sustainability commitments that we ourselves have been engaged in and practicing over time, we have only had to, if you like, increase the scope coverage to cover COVID-19 in particular. Otherwise, we have operated all the other things the way we have been operating. So yes, we engage the community, but we try to limit it to only when it is very, very needful. And also when it comes to our wider stakeholders, we are using, and indeed we are using even avenues like Zoom to engage statutory bodies that would have come here, or we would have had to go and meet with them in the city or elsewhere for meetings and discussions. So yes, we are adapting to the new normal that is calling for behavioral change, that is calling for a change in our practices in terms of social events and the like. So I would say that yes, in that regard, we are resorting to some of the emerging new normals and responding appropriately, so that we are able to maintain our production and also at the same time make sure that we do so safely and responsibly.
Thanks very much. And Roland, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. Are you getting me?
Yes, no, I can hear you. Thank you very much indeed. I was let me put that the question that I put to Samuel but to you, and it's really around countering the challenge of verifying activities from suppliers on the ground. So how have you been and your team been able to continue monitoring for environmental or human rights risks and issues in supply chains?
Okay, so basically, I would say that we are still in the process of certification. Our operations have been certified. We just completed our OOT audit. So basically, you would imagine that during the audit, all control points were verified by auditors, and so this means that we're still in compliance with environmental risks. And so basically also we have our monitor evaluations, internal monitor evaluation systems that actually follow up all the activities on the grounds and reports on progress made. So basically, we have this internal monitor evaluation system, we have our internal auditing system, and we have external audits that are actually ongoing that will actually determine our compliance level.
Ian, can I come in and to make up?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. Yes. In addition to our own internal monitoring and auditing protocols, which are not new, but we just continue them under COVID, I just told you in my introduction that we had our annual surveillance audit for RSPO certification last week. And initially, there would have been a combined team of locals and others coming from SCS Global outside this country. But under COVID, we agreed that an all-local team, which they themselves had cultivated over time, was competent enough to do the audit. So the audit was done in person, verifying the various standards and practices in our operations. So again, we are happy that our certification body had, over the period that they have been operating in Ghana, local staff who were competent enough to do the whole audit without anybody coming in from outside the country. So again, that gives us, that is a plus for our, if you like, certification body and also our country, Ghana. When it comes to independent audit and verification, we are happy that there is a local team that is competent. And of course, before when they came in, we subjected them to all the necessary tests and protocols, and we were fine. So I think that going forward, That is what all the other kind of, for instance, EFI may look at, that you have very competent teams in the various countries and geographies so that they can always do the verifications and assessments. And who knows, that could be developed further if you want some amount of independence. Now technology abounds and we can use some of the technology to be able to like Zoom and cameras and drones and things like that, to be able to transmit some of the inspections and assessments so that it is, if you like, independent enough.
Great, no, thank you. It's very interesting that the development of local capacity is perhaps going to be an outcome from the COVID-19 pandemic. I'd like to thank you, by the way, to audience questions. We're 15 minutes left. I really would like to use this time to answer questions from the audience. So now is the time to put your questions to our panel, and we will use those questions as we get through the remainder of our time. I want to put a question to Akiva. Questions about how balanced the Accountability Framework Initiative is in terms of looking at social and economic challenges and balancing those with environmental impact. So Akiva, if you could just very briefly explain how the balance between social, economic and environmental is met in the accountability framework.
Sure. Yeah, so the accountability framework is comprised of 10 core principles plus underlying operational guidance that fleshes out those principles. And they are firmly divided between environmental and social principles. So protecting forests and other ecosystems, and then protecting human rights and labor rights is the latest addition to the set of guidance. And the organizations that were involved in drafting the guidance were a mix of environmental NGOs like WWF, as well as NGOs that focus on human rights and other social issues. And these, we've spent a lot of time making sure that the two sort of angles weave together very nicely in the guidance, so that what we're working with companies to implement is not overly focused on one angle or the other. The economic piece is sort of at the background of everything. Guidance is intended to enable companies to continue producing commodities that are implicated in deforestation and conversion and human rights abuses in a way that mitigates against those effects. So the framework is never trying to suppress production in any way. In fact, we are often trying to find ways to increase yields on existing land so that we don't need to be expanding footprints. So there's a nice sort of harmony between the desire to increase production of commodities while maintaining protections for nature and for people.
Thank you, Akiva. Moving on from that, I'd like to put a question from Eduardo in Colombia, who put this question to both to Samuel and to Roland. Both palm oil and cocoa supply chains clearly have a large number of smallholder farmer suppliers, which can have higher risks of child labour. So how specifically, Samuel and Roland, are you addressing dealing with child labour risks in your supply chains, particularly when those supply chains are not certified in any way? Samuel, do you want to go first on that one?
Yes. In our case, as I told you, it is part of the way we work here, our practices, that child labour is a no-no. So even when you go to our condition or the collective bargaining agreement between us and our employees, it is enshrined in it that child labor is a no-no on our plantation. And we deal with our smallholders and outgrowers with the same kind of standard. And so education on child labor we have collaborated with other institutions and non-governmental organizations to educate and address the issue of child labor. So I can say that in our operations in the oil palm sector in Ghana, and in particular in Benso oil palm plantation, we have a model that has demonstrated that yes, child labor can be eliminated and yet production should not be affected. But let me take a step back and try to address the issue of the balance between the social and economic. And I would say that, and just permit me to read a short excerpt from a Reuters news item, Kuala Lumpur, June 23, 2020. It says that the exports of Malaysian crude palm oil to the African continent are expected to increase to about 9 million metric tons this year, compared to the average of 6 million metric tons per year over the past decade. And it goes on to say, while Africa accounts for around 12-13% of global CPO consumption, it only accounts for just about 4% of global CPO production. And that's African players, this calls for African players and Asian producers to tap into this potential. And citing an example, they mentioned Kenya, Tanzania, Ghana, Ethiopia, Djibouti as countries among the growing markets for CPO in Africa. So you can see that because palm oil is also a food security issue, demand for palm oil in COVID is increasing because it is food. And when people, whether they are in lockdown or they are going up and down, they must eat. And rice and oil are the most easiest and available foods that people would want to eat. So it is a food security issue, and this call for players in Africa and other places to up their game in terms of production must come with a balance that says that yes, we are addressing a food security issue, but we must also address the ecological security issues as well. And that is why frameworks like the AFI, the RSPO, and the REC, we believe that their existence has been more than justified. But specific to child labor, I think that these frameworks have adequately given guidelines on child labor. And so in COVID, it's not going to be otherwise. It's going to be maintained that if those companies that declare commitment to those frameworks must necessarily ensure that child labor is out of the question, even amid the pressure to increase production, child labor, like all the other sustainability requirements, cannot be compromised. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much indeed, Samuel. Roland, can I put the same question to you then? And just again, thinking in terms of the particular challenges around risks of child labour in supply chains, cocoa farms, often very small family-run farms, and clearly there are risks there. So how do you use AFI and other frameworks to identify and to help eliminate child labour risks?
Basically, we acknowledge the possibility of child labor in cocoa farms, and so that's why in Cameroon, Cargill, Banachu Witweka, we're implementing the child labor monitoring remediation system program. We've been running this program already for the second year, and the objective is to identify all child labor cases and to do a remediation activity. So basically, we implement child labor remediation system program. We started it in our pilot zones in Obala and Tui. We are scaling up this program to Bafia this year, and eventually we will scale up this program to all our supply chains. We do a house visit to identify possible child labor cases, and then we do eventually do remediation activities. So yes, there's a risk of child labor in cocoa farms, and we are already addressing this issue through our child labor monitoring remediation systems. We've done identification, and eventually we are going to remediation activities.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, can I come back and make up that?
Sure, okay. Samuel. Yes.
Also, as I told you, as part of our RSPO practices and other frameworks practices, we have in place what we call a positive assurance against child labor report. So every month, all my divisional managers have to complete and return a signed form that says that throughout the month that they are reporting on, they have neither seen nor encountered child labor in their operations during the month. And if they did encounter one, they have to state what action they took. So every month, every manager, a divisional manager, returns that form, and we call it a positive assurance against child labor. It puts child labor at the top of our minds, because every month, and for that matter, during the month, the manager goes around inspecting work that is going on in their divisions. They are supposed to be looking out whether there is any child labor incident. So again, that is a very practical, simple, but of course, it came out as a result of our, if you like, RSPO certification audits and surveillance audits. Auditors want proof that a particular practice is in place. And so we developed what we call a positive assurance against child labor. And that one, every manager has to return that form signed. And it gives us a certain, it makes the issue top of mind so that they remember to look out for it and to address it even if they see one. And that is what we have been doing. And it's worked so well. And I have not seen any incidents even over the past 6 months or even 1 year.
Thanks very much. A couple more questions I want to put to our panel. The first is about the role of government. And I just wonder from Samuel and Roland's perspective, how they found the what the kind of best practices that they've seen in terms of what government can do to help in such difficult times. Roland, perhaps you first. What's been, in your experience, what have been the things that government has done well to really help you and your suppliers get through the challenges that the pandemic has thrown up?
So basically, firstly, I would say the Cameroon government has actually implemented a couple of activities in regards of the COVID-19. What I would say needs more to be done is for the first to turn to the system of government in Cameroon. Basically, the system of government, economic system of government in Cameroon is a liberalized economic system, and a liberalized economy is one of the crises of a liberalized economic system. Is a disengagement of the government from activities of the private sector. In times like these and normally in other activities, I think if there's a return more to a stabilized system of government where the stabilized economic system where the government is more implicated in the activities of the private sector, that would help much both for the farmers or the supply chain actors and for the interests of the government. The liberalized system has not proven to be the best in terms of the farmers' interests, in terms of support structures, like companies that have to support farmers. The liberalized system has not proven to be the best because it limits what the government should do in terms of activities in the private sector. Secondly, I think it will be quite important if the government can keep on encouraging a public-private and civil society or partnership that would kind of encourage harmonization of activities. So basically, you have several supply chain actors intervening in the cocoa sector in Cameroon, and each one doing its own kind of activities. But if there's a kind of harmonization of efforts, then it would kind of help us, sustain the gains we've made already in sustainability. Or it would help us not to have repetition of activities. And that's why we're working with all that. That's why, for example, in Cargill, we believe in transformation together, working in partnership with other structures to be able to achieve transformational changes.
Great, thank you very much.
Yes, in our country, Ghana, I think that the whole fight against COVID-19 has assumed a national character. So there is a framework in place. There is a national COVID-19 team set up by the government, made up of very competent people, virologists and doctors and medical practitioners and disaster management organizations and things like that, using state institutions and things like that. Now, there's data that is available on a website created by the Ghana Health Service, and the data is available from the national level, the district level, and even community levels. So we are able to see what is going on from far away and also very close to us so that we can make informed decisions and judgment. The government has set up a COVID-19 fund, which is allowing companies and individuals to also contribute money so that the fight can be all increasing and all inclusive. And so, to that extent, I would say that the government's approach has been inclusive and is giving all of us the opportunity to contribute to it. And we actually have spent upwards of $79,000 distributing some of the things, the PPEs that are required by communities around us so that they can protect themselves adequately. So in that regard, if you talk about governments, I think the government has made it inclusive. And in terms of education, radio, and TV, the government is taking the lead role and showing the way. And we as a supply chain are doing our bit within that larger framework. And in terms of what is it that as a country, our approach and all of that. So yes, I think that, that has been supportive. And indeed, if there are companies or supply chains that are so vulnerable. There is a fund that is going to allow some of them to access money to be able to stay sustainable and viable. And I think that is a good thing. Just that we, from our posture and our standing, they will not see us as being vulnerable enough to be able to access some of those funds. And that is fine. So we allow that for the weaker ones and the smaller, the less strong value chains and the coastal value chains to be able to. And even in the era of lockdown, they still recognize that agriculture and food security was still very important. So they allowed us with some limited permission to be able to travel to the city to pick essential spare parts and medicines back to the plantation so that we could maintain our services to our employees and communities and also have our business running. And I think that leeway that the government gave, I think was also significant. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Samuel. I realize we have got a little bit over time, but there's one further question I want to put to our panelists, and it's this. And thinking in terms of looking forwards, what do you think is most needed when we emerge, or as we emerge from the pandemic, to ensure that we don't lose the positive gains that have been made in sustainability and through the hard work over the past few years? Let me put that to Samuel first. And if you could keep your answer reasonably brief, please, as I say, we are over time now.
Thank you very much. I think that if I take EFI, for instance, I think COVID-19 can be brought under one of the principles or the standards for us to look at. But now that COVID-19 has been bold and loud and specific, I think that we'll have to look at the health and wellness aspect of the framework and probably reinforce it with, let's say, pandemics, so that companies and value chains and supply chains are very specific on how they can ensure their preparedness and resilience against pandemics if they happen, whether COVID or another name that may come up. That is what I think. It gives us the opportunity to look at what we are doing already and probably reinforce them so that we can address pandemics specifically.
Okay, thank you, Samuel. Roland, same to you then. What is most needed once we emerge or as we emerge to ensure that we don't lose the kind of positive gains that have been made through everyone's hard work? Roland.
So I think the COVID-19 era has brought about a change. It has brought about a change in the way we work with our farmers. It has brought about a change in the way we planify our activities. And in case the COVID-19 comes to an end, which we would not supposed to lose sight of the fact that there can be another pandemic, then what is need? What do we need to do? We need to, in all our programs, we need to actually create a space for such kind of eventuality. So I think what we'll need to do for future time would be to create a space for, what can we do in case there is a pandemic. So I think we need to do a planification so that we should be proactive. We need to do a planification. In all our planification, we need to put that there's an eventuality that it could come. And if it comes, how do we react? So we need to go one step ahead. We don't need to say it has come, it has ended, it will not come again. We need to actually create a space in our counter action plans to indicate that there's a possibility that something can come up. And if it comes, how do we react to it?
Thank you, Roland. So clearly, make sure we learn from the experience so we're ready for the next time. Akiva, do you want to add any points on that, just in terms of from the AFI's perspective? What do you want to see in place to ensure that the gains made aren't lost?
Yeah, I would say that what we need is to continue the process that has been ongoing for the last couple of years of cementing the shift in thinking from avoiding the bad in supply chains to promoting the good, right? Historically, companies have tried to quote unquote green their supply chains by ensuring that nothing bad is entering. But I think we've realized in part because of this pandemic that in order to make sure that nothing bad enters in the future, you have to proactively invest on the ground in people, in nature, to allow for green supply chains going forward. So a lot of the work that Samuel and Roland have talked about, you know, investing in communities, providing PPE, that's the sort of thing that I think we need to see more of going forward, both with respect to human health and also with respect to health of the environment.
Thank you very much indeed, Akiva. Okay, I'm going to have to stop our discussions now as we have run out of time. Thank you so much to our panel for their time and insight. It's been fascinating to hear from Roland and Samuel in particular from their locations in Africa, telling us, you know, on the ground how they have been dealing with the challenges from the coming from the COVID-19 pandemic. We will be in touch to share a recording of this webinar, so you can listen to it again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. Can I just point out the on the slide in front of you, for more information about our Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum in November, please scan the QR code, loads of information online. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting. I've been Ian Welsh, and thank you very much indeed for joining us.